Accession number 30143, Reel 10.
I think the next day I booked up the same hotel in Kuwait City, and Kuwait City was such a different place. Suddenly it's, you know, all the roadblocks, I think some of the roadblocks are still there, but the air raid sirens are being taken down. No longer the military on every hotel entrance. It was just suddenly twice as much traffic on the streets. It was such a different feel, and or maybe in contrast to Baghdad, it was sort of very joyful and everyone a bit relaxed. But it was sort of doubly reinforced coming from the shell pitted and broken roads of Iraq to these smooth, freshly laid motorways, or street lighting. Everyone owns a four-wheel drive. Just a different world, such a different world. And allegedly, sort of, Iraq has more oil wealth sort of sitting under its soil than Kuwait. So, yeah, amazing contrast. And I can't remember the nitty gritty. Obviously, booked flights home and, you know, managed to get home.
You were there a couple of months?
2 months, yes. I think it was literally the day I flew home was the day that Bush was on the aircraft carrier and said, right, today the war ends. 1st of May, isn't it? Not too sure. 5th of May. Possibly 1st of May.
Yes. Did you think that he was being realistic from your experience?
Well, again, I felt in the dark about it. Yeah, it sounds daft when you're there in the middle of it, but I had no idea what was going on. And it was only when I chatted to my mum and dad saying, what's happened today?
Saw the television.
Yes, yes, what's CNN saying? And yeah, it was ironic. Yes, I suppose, thankfully, I had nothing but, I met nothing but nice Iraqis. The people I met were very kind to me, almost without fault, so I never really had a bad experience. It could have been very different, so yeah, I came back with quite positive feelings, and it was that euphoric moment when, yeah, damn Saddam.
But did they tell you of awful things, you know, that had happened under Saddam?
I found that more on the second trip, where we had sort of Iraqi translators, and in Afghanistan, I heard even more horrific things. But yes, I didn't hear it first person there. So.
Coming back after 2 months of, you know, such an unusual experience, you know, with all this sort of surreal and the danger, the risks, and the contrast that you've explained so well, how easy would it have been to settle to so-called normal life? You know, was it the fact that you had a lot of work to do with your...
I did, I came back, yes, I came back straight into my normal freelance work and trying to draw up these drawings. And, yeah, after a few weeks I thought, yeah, I've got to make an exhibition of this.
How much did you come back with that? You know, did you have several...
I had 3 or 4 sketchbooks, so... And the Times did a couple of double page articles on, you know, a war artist in war torn Iraq, and sort of post event drawings, so that, yes, it got quite a splash soon after, which was great for me, and good to get the drawings shown. Yeah, I think we did 2 or 3, so I was interviewed. Yeah, so this must have been May, June, July. They kept using drawings. I think 1 year on they used some of the drawings as a comparison. You know, they made the most of them, which obviously they'd spent quite a lot of money trying to follow that route. I don't remember finding it strange to readjust. I found it harder coming back after our sort of army tour, which I suppose was 8 months away, so maybe that I found really hard. But I have no sort of memories. It's still always in my mind. Something will remind me, or it's probably not an hour where something... And some sort of memory comes across from Iraq or Afghanistan.
For today, even?
Well, just because I was getting these out and rerouting through memories. Yes, maybe that brings it back again, so it's even fresher again.
And you know, finishing your sketches and paintings for your exhibition after this first time, did you notice a difference in your art? Had this affected it a great deal? Going to you know, the need for speed, and were you more confident with sort of...
I think so. Certainly the black and white line drawings, which I'd normally done in my sketchbooks, I'd never really noticed this before, but I'd never really shown anyone the drawings, or like my working drawings. But here they were, you know, suddenly became legitimate drawings in their own, and I'm still quite fond of some, and some I won't sell, of missile attacks where we're all in our respirators, and it just brings back so many memories of smudged paper and sweat inside a respirator, and yes, it brings back more than a photograph. Yes, as you say, I think there was a different sort of confidence, and drawing people and faces. Yeah, I've always drawn people, but never really sort of not portraits as such. Where, yes, I did find I was drawing slightly different things, and just black and white line opened up. Sort of meant, yes, I wasn't resting on anything comfortable. I couldn't go normally. You do things you're comfortable with. Yes, I know I can do a safe drawing, I can do that. Whereas this was all a bit unknown and a bit, oh God, is it going to work or is it not? Yeah, the whole thing was a challenge. Sorry, I can't remember much about being back home. I remember my wife organised a surprise party in a pub, a local pub, and said, oh, let's go for a beer, which I thought, that's strange, my wife and I, we never go to a pub for a beer. And we rocked up, and there were all my friends outside. I was like, oh, what a coincidence. That's so-and-so from the TA, and so-and-so from there. And so that was a great time, and, very strange. I remember someone being quite drunk and almost starting a fight with one of my friends until someone said, oh, we're celebrating Matt coming back from Iraq. And as soon as he said that, oh, no worries, mate, no worries, mate. And I think the pub landlord bought us a few beers and things. So it was... yeah, quite a different sort of atmosphere. I ended up getting married to my wife sort of about 4 months later. So, and I can guarantee, I think it was sitting on top of that hotel in Baghdad was the day I thought, I've never been one sort of wanting to get married, but suddenly I thought life is actually quite short and life is actually very simple. And from what I've seen, yeah, I just thought she's the one, and it was weird. On top of that hotel, what in fact it was as the Americans were throwing their hand grenades. I thought, I'm going to marry her. Not very romantic. No, I haven't told her that bit.
You should have been looking at palm grills.
Exactly, exactly. Well, that's something I didn't mention. We did explore a bit around the palm groves around Babylon, and within the palm groves, there are some of these. Sort of Russian-made frog missiles and vehicles packed full of mortar rounds. So they're obviously using the palm groves to hide all of this equipment. And it was, yeah, fascinating. And more relevant just because it was palm groves in Babylon. It's just amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so very strange. And very strange getting back to the TA and handing my sweaty body arm back. Rather naive.
Were you debriefed? I know you went as a war artist, but they were interested.
No. I worked out my expenses. I did actually bring some cash back, which I think is. I don't think it's ever happened before.
Is that unusual?
I believe so. They didn't quite know what to do with it. Probably screwed up their accounting. Yes, and trying to work out the expenses and Kuwaiti. It's Kuwaiti dollars, Iraqi dinars to pound sterling. It was so many different currencies, but anyway, yes, I got married, and then the talk through the TA was that we were going to get mobilised to Iraq, which no one saw coming. I think it was sort of discussed and thought it was more likely to happen when the war was on, but just no one. As soon as the war stopped, everyone thought, "Phew, they're not going to call the TA up." And sure enough, we got the word that we're going to get a trawl around for numbers. And this was... trawl around for numbers. People who were okay with going. And we had a camp down on Dartmoor where all the training was... obviously at this point the conflict had changed a bit. There was vehicle-borne IEDs and suicide bombers, maybe not at that point, But the conflict had changed, so it was all that sabotage and sniping and just bomb blasts, roadside bombs.
I suppose if you were now well up with the war, if you were watching what was going on.
Yes, although I think it went quite quiet on the news, and then you got the stuff coming back about the abuses from which happened just after I left, so that was disappointing. So it was, yeah, you know, just disappointed is the only way I can say it. It's just I think every soldier feels that, just ashamed when someone does treat badly. But I can honestly say I never saw anything apart from sort of good behaviour. So I've seeing it slightly from inside, but I still have best faith in them. And sure enough, come January, I must have got back in May. Yeah, I'd been married, and then my call-up papers came through. We got mobilised in September. So quite soon after coming back, a bit of a shock. So maybe that's why I can't remember that interim phase. It's just a bit of a blur. And obviously trying to arrange a wedding in 3 weeks was a bit hectic.
Oh, you've explained it well. Yeah. It's what
yeah, it's a bit of a blur. Yes.
Yeah.
We did, yeah.
So the call-up was in September 03, and you went on January...
January 04, yeah, 2nd of January. So
yes. When you joined the TA, did you ever expect that you'd go to war?
No, ironically. I got close to it during the first Gulf War. I was just joined the parachute regiment then, and literally got the... It was a different system then, but we got some call-out notebooks that said you will turn up with your 5 pairs of socks and your long johns at such and such. And that scared me, shit this. So all our training was for chemical warfare again. But thankfully it didn't happen. Yeah, obviously forgot about it after that. Yes, no one saw it. And least of all, the sort of peace support type operation or counterinsurgency. Everyone just assumed it would be a major conflict. It's the only time they're going to need that manpower. So a bit of a surprise. We went through about 2 months beef up training. We go to a place called Chilwell, which is where they sort of go through the administration for TA soldiers being mobilised, which is literally a sausage factory where you're sort of pumped full of anthrax jabs and tetanus and all the rest. You're given your weapons, given all your equipment, you make your wills, cover your insurance, equipment insurance, you just go through the whole palaver, you sign over the tax documents to say that you now come under the MOD. Yeah, just all that sort of administration, and you are just a number pumped through this machine, which is quite fascinating in its own way. I imagine something like that in the Second World War, going through conscription. So it was in its own, it was quite interesting experience. And then we did lots of sort of beef up training. I think we're going at the same time as one of the parachute regiments, so we're often doing training with them. We go through lots of briefs on the culture of the locals. We had Iraqi speakers from SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies, that sort of teach us some basics. Iraqi words of hello and thank you and do's and don'ts, and they don't palms of hands or soles of feet. And so it was a well organised and quite thorough. I think it sort of ended in 2 or 3 weeks of training and conducting convoy escorts. We did most of this down in Norfolk in December. A god awful World War II army base called Retham. And it really was still the corrugated iron Nissen huts where we froze.
Where was that, Retham?
Retham. Norfolk.
R-E-A-T-H-A-M.
Sounds like Retham. I think it's got an H. Yes, might have to confirm that. And so it was from there. We're doing a hell of a lot of physical exercise. We'd do 12 mile stretch races, carrying jerry cans and stretchers, and lots of 10-mile runs, and start every morning with a run. So yeah, it was good training. In hindsight, I know we all whinged about it and complained. Obviously, a lot more training on the weapons, on the general purpose machine gun, which was just going out of service at that time, but now being brought back in. And just getting us ready for a role which we still didn't really know what we were going to be doing, and none of our commanders really knew. There was lots of rumours of what we were going to be doing, so we didn't know until the day we rocked up. Eventually we got mobilised on, I think it was the 2nd or 3rd of January, so at least we had Christmas at home. And having complained about Norfolk and how this flat, cold, wet, windy landscape was nothing like, you know, Iraq, we got to Basra and it was cold, wet, windy and flat. It was exactly like Bretton. So in hindsight it was quite good, except we didn't have turnip fields to run around. So it was obviously winter, which I'd never seen, but to me it held no fears going to Basra. And I'd been drawing the horse archery firing from Basra Airfield, which is where we're based. It's very strange going back. The British, being British, had tried to tidy up some of the sort of conflict, some of the tanks and things. Their idea was that the less war debris lying around, the more people would forget about it and would move on with something next, which is great, a good idea, but not good if you want to go and do drawings out there. But spoiled all your fun.
Mentioning drawings, did the Times know you were going back, and were they interested?
I did let them know, and they were interested. And I did post, I posted drawings back with some colleagues whenever they went back on R&R, rest and recuperation. I'd just give them an envelope of drawings to take back, and quite a few of them got lost, which is ever so sad. I did try and keep photocopies at my end. You know, thankfully it was where a big enough location that there was a photocopier, and a few of the commanders would photocopy them for me. So I had a record, but yeah, so lost a few drawings that way. I don't think they ever used any after all of that, which is a bit frustrating. I think the Basra was a bit neglected, and it was all Baghdad, or I think for a spell it was just off the radar a bit, so I'm a bit of rocked out. The accommodation was very good. It was tented accommodation, but that can be a bit misleading. It's actually, I think, a Canadian made quite some plasticky nylon tents, but with air, huge generators outside and air conditioning pumped in. So it's actually quite an effective kit, and I think they use that in the Arctic as well, so it can be from two extremes. The only problem was, I think the generators cut out at about 40 degrees, or might have been 50 degrees, so when you really needed it, it just went ka-chum and stopped. So at the beginning of our tour, we had that tented accommodation. Towards the end, we got, I can't remember what you call it, it's actually sort of almost like a porter cabin accommodation, and ours had come from Bosnia, so it's still covered in mud and had, you know, sort of Bosnian M4, I can't remember what the Bosnian markings are, so you could see it had come from wet, muddy Bosnia. So we're sort of shifted. Yes, it was an interesting transition as we were there. I don't know where to start with this. I haven't really explained this trip. I was the section commander, so I was in charge of about 8 blokes. We took over a lot of our convoy escort duties from 2 para, I think. So we were popping down to Kuwait to bring up the aviation fuel for the helicopter force at the airport. We were escorting various engineers and people around Basra. Anything from, I think, military police were doing a few follow-up investigations from various crimes that happened during the war. So all sorts of weird things from engineers and all sorts of things. So. But this time we'd get very thorough intelligent briefs, and this was when the Muqtada al-Sadr uprising happened and conflict took quite a different turn, and those American contractors were hung in, is that Nazaria or wherever it was, so almost daily the mood would change. We'd be in our vehicles, sometimes the police, the Iraqi police, would be doing cutthroat signs to us as we drove through, you know, especially when that happened. And do you remember the Daily Mail printed those pictures of, they weren't real photographs, but of supposed torture, and again the Iraqis are going like this, you'll be dead, you'll be dead. And all the kids were throwing stones at the vehicles. So in a day the mood would change quite happily, but you'd still be getting thumbs up and kids would be running alongside the vehicles. We had three guys injured in an improvised explosive device, which probably about halfway through our tour, which brought it home that we're, you know, whatever job you're doing, you're still very vulnerable. One friend of mine lost his eye, and it was by a nut and bolt that was in the improvised explosive device. They call it shipyard confetti when you put nuts and bolts in a bomb to cause shrapnel. But it's, the guy's actually got this sort of Neanderthal looking skull. He's got quite big, you know, he's always teased about it, sort of big eyebrows. And it was purely because he had a thicker skull. It literally hit him in that corner, his eye popped out, but it didn't go into his brain, so he lived. And I got this job doing some drawings for a signals regiment. I only really took it on because it meant that I could get up to Baghdad, and a double excuse, I could go and see this guy in the American field hospital in the green zone. So myself and another guy, we must have flown up to Baghdad by Hercules. I managed to sit in the front of the Hercules as we plummeted down into Baghdad airport. It literally flew really high and then just spiralled down. It's quite a spectacular way of turning up. Then I remember driving in, it's known as White Fleet, so the British use a lot of civilian vehicles, so it's commonly known as White Fleet, and in that sun they are always white to reflect the heat. So we're using White Fleet vehicles, and we're taking some rather sensitive, it's called ECM equipment, which is electronic countermeasure, which sets out a pulse that supposedly stops some of these roadside bombs being initiated. It, you know, stops the mobile phone signals and key fob signals. And it's very sensitive equipment. There'd be a lot of trouble if it would soon be across the border into Iran if that was ever captured. So the vehicles all had phosphorus grenades to blow up if we were ever caught in an ambush or the vehicle looked like being captured. And of course on the, what do they call it, the most dangerous road on earth, the road from Baghdad airport into the green zone, we broke down, I think it was a broken fan belt, and I'd literally just arrived and it wasn't such a big deal, and having been to Baghdad I didn't feel, it's like, yeah, so what, it's not such a big thing. But anyway, pushed out into the two vehicles were there and the guys were heads over in the bonnets trying to fix up what was going on, and me and my mate pushed out into the sort of bit of a scrub line, and we're in a fairly wealthy sort of suburb, was just beyond. And I remember crawling round just to the bottom of the wall, I had my rifle sort of just lying down there, just, you know, just to keep eyes on, and thinking, oh, it looks like quite a posh suburb. There was a couple of people wandering around, chatting by a vehicle, thought, oh, I feel quite safe here. And then I looked down, and that's lying in a huge pile of Kalashnikov empty cases. It was obviously some Iraqi's firing point where they'd either ambushed Americans or something. So I thought, okay, maybe it's not such a safe location. But thankfully, after 10, 20 minutes, I managed to get moving again. And when you go under any of the bridges, you swerve across lanes, because I think it had already been found that either kids or, you know, insurgents would clock where your vehicle was coming. The opposite side, they'd drop a hand grenade into your vehicle. So going under any bridge, it's change lane, or if the road is clear, it's swerve right across, so you come out at a different location just to screw it up. So bridges were always a scary one. Yes, then we stayed into the green zone. So at last, having not seen it from, you know, the year before, Ray, I was there, and it was the cross swords I could see close up. It was fascinating, and one of the signals guys sort of showed me around. Yeah, it was like being, I could look across the river from one of the Sanger positions and see the hotel where it had been. It had been hit by a suicide bomb or a car bomb, which is a bit of a shame. I don't know, months before, but I think the bottom story had been blown out. So, yeah, it was very strange. We got mortared that day in daylight, which was a bit unheard of. and I think we were up on some high ground near the Perfume Palace. Again, I'd never had a map of the area, so I was always a bit disorientated. I know the Perfume Palace is somewhere near the airfield. And being high up and climbing up this antenna just to get a look over the city, and we could hear some firefights that the Americans were getting into about a kilometre away, and you could see red smoke being popped, calling the helicopters, and you could hear the machine gun fire getting more and more frantic. It was quite creepy seeing it and not being able to help. You could got your adrenaline pumping. And then these mortar rounds came over us and landed on the other side, again, sort of 800 metres away. But to actually see them in daylight, you know, the black puffs of smoke, it's like, oh my God. So I felt a bit exposed on top of this tower overlooking the whole city, thinking, yeah, they should do me. I'm sure they weren't, but you couldn't help. So, yeah, very different conflict. And I remember popping into the hospital to go and see a friend who'd been injured. His face was like a balloon. And I think
the one who lost his eye.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I think this was almost the first or second day of the Muqtada al-Sadr uprising. And so the Americans are firing artillery into the city, into the Sadr city. Yes, I remember being out for a run that evening, going up the Iraqi War Memorial to the Iran-Iraq war. There's a big dome. Once you get above there, you're exposed to the whole city. And they've been coming under occasional sniper fires. And as soon as this artillery barrage went over my head into the city, I sort of rushed back to get my body armour. There's no one else around. Once you're down on the street level, they'd put up screens, just canvas screens, as a sniper screen, just so you wouldn't be able to see individuals wandering around. So you felt reasonably safe. But suddenly on top of this war memorial, you could see the whole city, and likewise they could see you. But anyway, we popped into the field hospital, and because of the uprising, there were Black Hawks bringing in casualties constantly. I remember just walking through, it just felt, going back to this film set analogy, it just didn't feel real. There were wounded Iraqis handcuffed to beds, and they'd blown off legs, and a lot of it, there was just glimpsed, but it sort of etched there in the mind. And yes, went to see my friend. His head was like a balloon, and the surgeon had proudly kept this nut and bolt that had lodged in his eyebrow. And an American guy came up to me, who was still in shock, had just been caught in an ambush. He just came up to look at my rifle, as you know, any troops do. Hey, show us your weapon. How does it work? And he'd lost a finger, and his hand was all splintered. And he was just telling me a story how they'd. It was like Black Hawk Down, where they're ambushed from a rooftop, their convoy, and they'd taken a turn into a dead-end street where they had to get out of their vehicles and kick the doors in and take cover inside various people's houses. And just, he said everyone in his squad had got injured in the contact. Everyone was injured. So it suddenly escalated. Mid-tour, it just went out the wall. And from then on, I think, back in sunny Basra, the airport used to get mortared and rocketed, and up till then the airport where we were based was always quite safe. It's such a vast area, and it was always Basra Palace that got mortared, or you know, one of the other locations. And allegedly when the intelligence brief came out that Basra International Airport got rocketed, got 15 rockets last night, all of these locations, they went yes, they all cheered. at last we were getting it as well.
So that was a sure sign, I expect.
Yes, it literally mid-tour it escalated and got quite nasty, and I think continued almost from then till now. So.
End of reels 9 and 10, Matthew Cook.